So my name's Luke Anderson, and I started getting involved in 1997 when I started hearing about the exports that were coming from the United States ending up in supermarkets in Britain containing genetically engineered ingredients. So I started doing research for a number of months together with someone else in Totnes, Dr. Bry Linus. And then started doing talks, photocopying information, distributing information and leaflets about genetic engineering. And then in March and April of 1998, I heard about plans to plant a field trial of genetically engineered corn right next door to Riverford Organic Farm, and which was about a mile down the road from where I lived at the time, and met with the farmer Guy Watson, and together a number of us organized a demonstration at the proposed trial site for the genetically engineered corn, and 600 people turned up. And it really caught people's attention here, where a lot of people get their weekly vegetable boxes from Guy Watson. We did pretty much everything that we could as a community grassroots campaign. We had a resolution sent from our local council opposing the field trial. We gathered support from other groups, for example, the Friends of the Earth and the Soil Association, to help launch a lawsuit against the British government. And in that lawsuit, we alleged that the government was acting unlawfully because it had failed to follow certain regulations that it needed to do to allow this trial to be taking place. We lost, we went to the Court of Appeal, and in the High Court, in the Court of Appeal, the judge ruled that he had neither the willingness nor the power to order that this field trial of genetically engineered corn be pulled up. Now, the government said that the likelihood of cross-pollination was in the order of 1 in 30,000 at the distances involved. That means that 1 in 30,000 of the organic farmers' kernels of sweet corn could potentially be cross-pollinated, and they judged that that was a risk that was irrelevant. A few months later, we had a report commissioned by the National Pollen Research Institute, which just a very short search on the available scientific databases found that the order of cross-pollination was likely to be more like 1 in 93. So much for the government's independent advisory committee that hadn't even bothered to look at the scientific literature available on this matter. So the community was upset, to say the least, by the time that the judge ruled that he was not going to order this field trial be pulled up. 20 people in the end, just about 2 weeks before the crop was due to pollinate, went into the field, removed the corn, and two women were arrested and were charged with £605,000 worth of criminal damage for an area of corn about 30 meters squared. They then faced bail conditions, which included a 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew in their own homes. They had to sign on in the police station every day. They weren't allowed out of London. All this for pulling up plants which no one wanted put there in the first place. But the women saw this as a great opportunity to put genetic engineering on trial in front of a jury. And so they, together with others, gathered together evidence on the failures of the regulatory system, the hazards to the environment and to the organic farmer, and created a defense which was based on the fact that they had a lawful excuse to commit criminal damage because they believed that they were acting to protect the environment and the farmer from the hazards associated with this genetically engineered corn. Just a week before they were due to go to trial, and the trial had a lot of media attention, and 5 weeks were set aside in the Crown Court for the trial. Just a week before they were due to go to trial, the defense submitted their evidence. Within 24 hours received a one-line letter from the director of the prosecution service saying that, quote, for complex reasons, the Crown had decided to withdraw the case. In the words of the solicitor, Michael Schwartz, this was an unprecedented and definitely political decision based on the controversy that was raging at this time over the future of genetic engineering. Because by now, we're up to February 1999, and at that time, the supermarkets were falling over themselves to remove genetically engineered ingredients from their own brand products. There were major political scandals, for example, involving Dr. Arpad Pushtai and his sacking from the Rauert Institute after he had the gall to go on public television and say that he thought that the public were being used as guinea pigs because there wasn't any safety testing being done. So there was a lot of attention at this time, and the last thing the government wanted to see was a jury, microcosm of the British society, freely acquitting people who are admitting taking direct action against genetically engineered crops. But unfortunately for the government, just a year later, 28 Greenpeace activists did go in front of a jury for pulling up a genetically engineered crop. And even though the prosecution did their best to condemn the activists, the spokesperson for Aventis, one of the biotech companies, speaking for the prosecution, said that she thought that you were more likely to get pregnant from a toilet seat than you were for a genetically engineered crop to contaminate a neighboring farmer's field. Anyway, the jury didn't buy that. And they not only acquitted the defendants, but lined up outside the courtroom afterwards, gave them flowers, shook their hands, and thanked them for acting in the public interest. So I got involved really with the local grassroots campaign against genetic engineering here in Totnes, that, and then linked together with other groups and activists that were forming all around the country at the end of the 90s. We helped in the formation and support for a number of groups in the Southwest. And then increasingly I got asked to write and travel and speak about genetic engineering, and also to share the experience of what people have been doing here in Britain in other countries such as Australia, New Zealand, and in North America, where the supermarket actions, the other kinds of protests and demonstration that people had used here in Britain, and in fact the other attempts at lobbying that people had used here in Britain, were ideas that were valuable and helped seed new actions and new activist groups in other countries. I think my sort of political, social consciousness had been affected by going for a number of years to weekly talks at the Schumacher College, which was just a few hundred meters from where I live. There we heard people like Vandana Shiva and other activists from around the world talking on a variety of global issues, whether it was logging or illegal dams or the arms trade or advances in new science and new physics or whatever. So all of these ideas were building inside me. And when I heard about genetic engineering, for some reason genetic engineering was the straw that broke the camel's back, and in a way it crystallized a lot of the things that were really disturbing me about human life on this planet at this time. Third world issues, increasing power and dominance of transnational corporations, the threats to the environment, in particular the fact that genetic engineering represented a threat that was irreversible. That really brought out this sense of urgency in me that the time to act was right now. Also food issues and human health issues. For years I've been very interested in nutrition and food, and had been involved in doing organic cookery. And so for many of these reasons and others, the impact on small farmers around the world, the fact that 25,000 people are dying every day from hunger in a world which is overproducing food, all of these things were very present and real for me in the issue of genetic engineering. And one of the things that excited me about genetic engineering is that wherever people came into the issue, whether it was from the environment as a priority or because they were concerned about the food they were giving their children, all of these very obvious relationships were made clear in the issue of genetic engineering. For the first time in the tabloid press in Britain, we heard people talking about the World Trade Organization with something concrete to root it in. The discussion, for example, that British people might have to be drinking milk if they drink cow's milk from cows injected with genetically engineered growth hormone, because the United States could pressure the Europe through the World Trade Organization. These and other examples helped make people really aware of the systemic problems that are affecting the world at this time, and the fact that none of these issues can really be separated, can be fought on their own. If we, for example, have a mass victory against genetic engineering in Europe, we still live in one world. We're still going to be receiving food from other places in the world, which is likely to be contaminated. We still have to think about the social issues of dominance of the richest countries in the world and how that's affecting the very fabric of social relations. And as we can see right now, a society which grows increasingly insecure as a result of the terrorism, which no doubt partly arises from the inequality that we're currently seeing. So it was an issue that kept my attention, and it was an issue that really, I feel, acted as a gateway for a lot of other people into a broader radicalization on a variety of issues, especially when, for example, people in their communities do everything that a community can do legally to object to a field trial that the local farmers don't want, the local people don't want, that is going to pose a threat to local interests. When a community does everything that they can, and they know that they've done everything that they can, and they're seen to have done everything that they can, and the only thing at the end of 3 months of campaigning that gets that field trial out of the ground is people going into the field and being willing to remove it and taking so-called illegal direct action, that really has brought a lot of people into a deeper appreciation and understanding for the reasons why people take direct action, and the fact that direct action is an expression of power, and it's been an expression of community power on this issue, as it has in many others. I, for example, have had countless experiences of hitchhiking or just generally talking with people about these issues, and they have, when the issue of direct action associated with genetically engineered crops come up, almost universally expressed support for it. I think there have been so many factors involved in the growing awareness and opposition to genetic engineering in Britain. I think it's really impossible to isolate one particular factor as having more or less of an impact than many of the others. If I look at all the different reasons why people have taken action on genetic engineering issues, if I look at what informed myself, for example, in the first months when I was starting to take action on this issue, it was a variety of things. It was hearing from inspirational people from around the world who'd been taking action on this issue for years. It was reading a leaflet. I remember a leaflet that was posted in the local health food store, I think produced by the Natural Law Party, that really taught me a lot about genetically engineered soy and why it was a problem and made me want to do something. It was going to a talk and leaving that talk, talking with someone else at that talk who was similarly upset as I was, and not being able to go to sleep that night and thinking, oh, but this was an issue I had to do something about. You know, my ambition at that time only extending to producing a leaflet for the local community. It was the fact that there was a community of people around the country that sustained me, that I felt like I could be part of a family of a bunch of people around the country who were also just people like me who were getting incensed and finding out whatever they could, educating themselves, and working together to see how we could oppose this in a grassroots way. So the sense of community relationships was very important. It was the fact that we had victories. This was an extremely lucky campaign to be involved in. We had victories all the time, not least because of the fact that we knew that we would have a victory at the end of each season if we really wanted to with a particular field trial, by removing it from the ground, whatever the government or local council or local farmers chose to do. But it was also victories on all kinds of other levels. The fact that the press, the mainstream corporate media, got excited about genetic engineering, you know, maybe because of the scandals and because of the sensational factors that were associated with it. I remember when the Daily Mirror, during the Pushtai, the all the controversy surrounding Pushtai, had a front page newspaper with Prime Monster as the banner headline, with a picture of Tony Blair with his head computer altered so that his head was squared and face was green and there were bolts sticking out of his neck. I mean, this was really fun for the tabloid press to get a feeding frenzy around. And when we had, you know, even the mainstream broadsheets like the Independent on Sunday having a skull and crossbones next to their weekly genetic engineering features, I think this was a big help. We got helped by the media and the fact that this was an interesting story to them. We were helped by the companies probably more than anything, by the appalling nature with which the companies tried to promote genetic engineering in this country. Stanley Greenberg, for example, who was a polling advisor for Tony Blair and Gerhard Schroeder and Bill Clinton, did some work for the biotech industry in Europe after Monsanto's 1998 advertising campaign, in which they put out full-page advertisements in the weekend supplements for the newspapers. And Stanley Greenberg said that more people were opposed to genetic engineering after Monsanto's advertising campaign than they were before, and went on to say that there were large forces making acceptance of genetic engineering in Britain problematic. What those large forces were the community groups, the small groups of people, mostly working unpaid, who were taking action on genetic engineering issues, church groups, the Women's Institute, the environmental groups. So it's important to remember, for example, that in a country of bird lovers and wildlife lovers, supposedly, with at least, I think, 2 million people, members of the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, when the mainstream conservation groups like English Nature and RSPB come out saying that genetically engineered crops could have a devastating impact on already declining farmland wildlife, there's a lot of people in this country who are going to get upset about that, who are going to take action as a result of hearing that. And of course, it was a very well-coordinated, well-established grassroots and direct action network in Britain that had gone from strength to strength through a number of campaigns over the last years, who decided that genetic engineering was going to be a major focus. And I know that for many people around the country, the experience and the skills of this network was absolutely essential to our continued involvement in the genetic engineering campaign. One of the things that's really noticeably different about the campaigns or the countries that have grassroots genetic engineering campaigns that are really successful, that I've noticed through traveling and speaking about genetic engineering in other countries, is the diversity of tactics and approaches and perspectives that are brought into the genetic engineering campaign in Britain. If I look at the United States, for example, what I see is a big separation between a lot of the non-profit organizations that are working on the issue and many of the grassroots activists that have been working on this issue, whether it's through direct action or through local campaigning against local supermarkets, for example. There's a big gap. There's less of a gap here in Britain. And one of the things that gives the campaign in Britain its strength, as it does in, for example, New Zealand, Aotearoa, New Zealand, where there's also a very strong campaign, is the fact that there is people from all walks of life getting involved. So one of the things I've noticed about the campaigns that have been really successful in other countries and in Britain has been the kinds of people that have been getting involved and the diversity of approaches to the activism that have been taken. In Britain, for example, what I saw happening around the genetic engineering issue is a lot of people who hadn't been active for more than a decade, who, for example, had been active around nuclear issues in the 80s, but had then gone on and had families or done other things. We're getting involved in the genetic engineering issue for the first time, and my speculation is that perhaps something about the nature of nuclear issues and the long-term nature of the contamination associated with nuclear issues, or the potential devastation to planetary ecosystems associated with nuclear issues, have also been a factor in mobilizing those people around genetic engineering issues, where a lot of the issues are parallels. In Britain, there have been large amounts of the day-to-day activism, the writing the letters, the making the phone calls, things that have really shifted the supermarkets, for example, and also government on local and national levels, have been action taken by older women. And I think they tend to be on the videos and the films that we see about genetic engineering, perhaps a quieter voice. You know, it's often people taking direct action, or people who are speaking, or other people that are filmed. Whereas actually, it's a lot of the people that have been less seen, that have been perhaps in the background, you know, as far as some people's perspective is concerned, who've really been an essential part of the backbone of the genetic engineering campaign in Britain, and I see that in other countries as well. And one of the things that there is in Britain that there isn't, for example, in the United States, is there's a lot more time. There's a lot more ability for people to get involved in volunteer issues. I'm not saying that people have a lot of free time in Britain, you know, most people don't. But in the United States, hardly anyone has any free time. Okay, well, one of the things that I think is really important for us to be aware of is just how much of a victory there's been for the genetic engineering campaign in Europe and in Britain. Just 5 or 6 years ago, we thought that we were on the verge of a tidal wave of new approvals of genetically engineered crops. We were expecting literally hundreds or thousands of new genetically engineered crops to have been approved within the coming years. We also thought it was inconceivable that the supermarkets would remove genetically engineered ingredients from their own brand products. Now what do we see? We see every major supermarket not only having pledged to remove genetically engineered ingredients from the human food products, but also most of them now from the animal feed that is being used for animal produce sold in their stores. We see farmers who 5 years ago were mostly very much in support of a future of genetic engineered crops and the advantages that that might give them, now increasingly hostile to the idea of a food supply controlled by the transnational corporations and, in particular, genetically engineered crops. We see the government being advised by its bureaucrats that it would face a rural revolt if it tried to allow full-scale approval of genetically engineered crops at this time. We see a country that 5 or 6 years ago had no sense, really, in terms of major public awareness about what genetic engineering was, why they should be opposed to it. It's now almost universally opposed to the idea of genetic engineering and very well educated on the issues, not just the issues associated with food, but very well educated on the issues associated with transnational corporations, third world hunger, etc. So we have seen major victories, and people shouldn't forget that all around the world, people look to the campaign in England, in Scotland, in Wales, and as a victory, as something to take inspiration from, as some way to imagine that the action that they're taking in other countries around the world could lead to successes, even though it seems impossible, even though it seems that the powers promoting genetic engineering are way too great for us to expect any real success. I think what we can also see as a success is that even though there are now millions and millions of hectares of genetically engineered crops planted around the world, they're still essentially planted in the same countries that they were a number of years ago. It's still the United States, Canada, Argentina and China. That's where it's being planted. We don't yet have any full-scale commercial approval in any major scale in Europe. Yes, we do have planting in Spain and in other places, but it's nothing like the scale that it is in the United States. That is a victory. The fact that Tony Blair's government has been gnashing at the teeth, like wanting to commercialize genetically engineered crops for years now, and it still can't. It still can't find a way to spin the introduction of genetically engineered crops. The public debate that it tried to create as a way to massage public perceptions associated with genetic engineering failed miserably. The increased education and information that the government have put out associated with genetic engineering have had exactly the opposite effect than that expected by the government. The more information people have about genetic engineering, the more they tend to be opposed to it. These citizens' juries that groups such as ActionAid have done around the world with farmers in India, for example, or in Brazil, again, coming out unanimously opposed to genetic engineering, even when they get equal input of information from those promoting genetic engineering and those opposed to it. We are winning in terms of the arguments about genetic engineering. We're winning, and we were winning at the end of the 90s when the industry started appearing in public debates, thinking that by stacking the debates four in favor to one against, they would somehow be able to convince crowds of hundreds of people that genetic engineering was a good thing. Again, they almost universally got booed out of the halls, the public not buying their arguments. we're winning on so many levels. Where we're not winning, of course, is in the bigger picture of global power relations at this time. But what we are doing is we are building stronger relationships between different movements. In genetic engineering, for example, in the United States recently, there was a large protest against genetic engineering that brought together people from the anti-war movement, which had been considerable in the United States during the war against Iraq, together with environmentalists, together with people who are concerned about nutrition issues, together with third world activists, together with, you know, all kinds of other sectors. Now, this is something that's really just starting to happen with genetic engineering as a focus in the United States. But it's been happening in Britain and in other countries for years now. People have been working across issues and coming from different perspectives and bringing their perspectives. It's absolutely essential that different perspectives, whether it's to do with race or class or environment or social justice or human health, all of these issues brought together in the battle over genetic engineering. And that's something that I know that I've needed for my own education and evolution in terms of my perspectives, and has been valuable for a lot of other people as well. Because this isn't just an argument about the genetically engineered soybean. It is an argument about the kind of world that we're living in, who is in control of the decisions made in this world, whether or not we want to live in a genetically engineered future, because we're not talking about just corn and tomatoes and soybeans, of course, we're talking about fish. Within a decade, if the industry has their way, we will see genetically engineered fish in the fish farms, genetically engineered trees used in industrial tree plantations, genetically engineered microorganisms used in a range of different processes, both agricultural and pharmaceuticals, genetically engineered food crops, grains, fruits, vegetables, genetically engineered pharmaceutical crops, both animals and plants, engineered to be drug factories for the pharmaceutical industry. For example, human genes engineered into corn plants so that the corn plants contain a rare class of human antibodies that attack sperm, so that the corn plants can be used as plant gel contraceptives. Or goats engineered with spider silk genes so that the goats can be milked for the spider silk protein to be used by the United States military for the development of protective clothing. These are all things that are happening now in the experimental stage, and which we can expect to see on a commercial stage within the next decade. What we're talking about is the complete artificial recreation of this world that we're living in. As one critic put it, the global reseeding of the Earth's biosphere with a laboratory-conceived second genesis. People are going to look back at this time in history and say, this is a time when humans had the choice. Humans could have made the decisions that were going to mean whether or not their world was a genetically engineered one. This is what we're talking about. And as we move into nanotechnology and the nanobiotechnology as well, we see where the momentum is going, where the corporate and the momentum of the elites that are currently in control of the world power relations are going. And it is towards a world that I don't think many of us want to live in, many of us want to be part of. A lot of the place where I draw my nourishment from is of course, the natural world and the natural systems that somehow remind me that there's something other than human stupidity on this planet. And when that natural world, supposedly, or so to speak, is increasingly an artificial creation designed to churn out corporate profits, I think that's going to be a great loss to many of us. And we can take action now. We have seen that against all the odds, we've been able to win here in Britain to a large extent and in other countries around the world. And it's just really a matter of like keeping that inspiration and keeping that focus and building a broad movement that is rooted in a systemic critique of global power relations, of our human relationship with the environment. I think the key lessons I have had through working within genetics campaign has been that a campaign both locally and globally that's rooted in good human relationships. That's one thing that's been very important, that the power of deciding together with people, the power of people who are working on this issue because of their passion, not because it's just been chosen as the issue of the month. I think, you know, one of the things that's been really important to the success of the campaign here has been the fact that there were NGOs who were working on this issue for years and years, whether it was on patent issue or third world hunger issues or genetic engineering and environment and human health issues in particular. And that those NGOs, when the grassroots movement really started building, and the momentum from the ground up, so to speak, those NGOs acted in a very valuable support role. They were there to really do a lot of the groundwork on education, on making sure that we were well educated. Some of the scientists, for example, put a lot of time into offering support for those of us who weren't experts to really be able to speak with authority on these issues. And there was a great amount of solidarity expressed. So the NGOs played their role, and then the grassroots movement were able to get educated and were able to know what the new developments were that they should be looking out for. In other countries where I've seen where the campaign has been led by NGOs noticing that this is an issue in other countries that's really getting a lot of support, and then introducing campaigns in a very particular style, for example, against a particular company, but without cultivating that grassroots support, either through funds or through actual relationships, more importantly, through being willing to sit round a table as equals with grassroots activists and, you know, people who were coming from a variety of different perspectives. When that hasn't happened, as it hasn't happened in some other countries, the campaigns have failed. They haven't had any life. They haven't really had any vitality, and they've wondered why tactics that they've copied from other countries haven't had the success that they have in other countries. Well, of course, there's reasons to do with different power structures and transnational corporations being more powerful in some countries than in other countries, and the governments being even further removed from the people than they already are in Europe. But I think there's a lot to do with just what happens when people are willing to work with each other and respect each other from all of these different sectors of activist movements, from the NGOs, from the direct action groups, from the local environmental groups or whatever. And that's something that I've seen that has happened to a great extent in Britain. There have been lots of problems, of course, as to be expected. But there have been countries where there haven't been any of that willingness to really sit down together and work out problems and work out strategy together, knowing that there are different sectors that play different roles, that all of those roles in building a diverse movement have been extremely valuable. We know, for example, that ecological systems are less vulnerable when they're more diverse. And when there is more biodiversity in a system, it is more able to resist attack. It is also more resilient. It's quicker to respond to disease. It is more powerful and more vibrant. So in this campaign, we've seen that when the industry has tried to attack, it's had to think in terms of its strategy and its tactics at focusing on this, you know, to them, what must appear to be a many-headed beast. They don't quite know where to attack, because if they try to chop off one head, there are 100 other heads appearing. And whereas in countries where there are just one, you know, very particular kind of tactic or one particular kind of strategy that's been used, it's been much more easier for the public relations machine and the government and industry machine to focus on that and try to take it out. So I think a really interesting lesson is to think of strategy around movements and around activism as we think of ecological systems, as we're starting to understand ecological systems. And what is it going to take to build a strategy that is diverse, that is able to respond to the opportunities that are offered? If there's an opportunity offered in the area of direct action, then to take that. If there's an opportunity with some particular piece of legislation that we can kill, or some piece of international legislation that we know is going to be valuable at, you know, restricting the excesses of the World Trade Organization or whatever. We need to take advantage of those opportunities. And in order to take advantage of those opportunities, we need different skills available to us. We need different perspectives. And so I think that really has been the most valuable lesson for me in the genetics campaign in Britain. And so in terms of thinking about strategy as we think of ecological systems, one of the failures I've seen in other countries has been the idea that we can take a tactic that's worked somewhere else and bring it into the genetics campaign and expect that it's going to work, or a tactic that an NGO has used successfully in fighting logging, for example, and imagine that that can necessarily be used in the genetics campaign, because that is much, in ecological terms, that's a bit like thinking that we can take a plant from one ecosystem where it has certain properties and introduce it into another ecosystem just because we want those properties in that ecosystem and imagine that it's all somehow going to work out. But of course, introducing foreign organisms into new ecosystems has a range of unpredictable and unexpected effects associated with it. So we need to think very carefully when we're taking advantage of different tactics or different strategies, that they're really appropriate for the context. And I'm not saying, of course, that, you know, we don't just try all kinds of things, because my experience with the genetics campaign has been that people have pretty much tried everything that they can think of, and some of those things work and some of them don't. And that, I think that's often a, you know, just the way that things happen in practice. But I think it's useful to think about that.